Buongiorno everybody and welcome back to the second and last day of this Windows Identity Foundation workshop. Congratulations for everyone among you who survived and are still here. Do you have any questions from yesterday? Think about it. Think about it. Are you sure? All right, no questions. So, somebody yesterday asked me if our cookie format is following any open standard. Well, it isn't. Let's say that it's just the reflection of whatever we do on the session token handler. That's it. Like, there is no standard that we follow. And in fact, also is completely configurable. So if there is any standard that you like, you can happily snap to that and use it. All right. And that said, the menu for today has as a starter, it's pretty heavy starter, Windows Identity Foundation and Windows Communication Foundation. So the architecture stuff is pretty much behind us. Today, we are going to spend the time on the object model, on the code, and similar. So we'll still do some consideration, of course, like there is nothing wrong with doing architecture, but that's just for setting your expectations. And how are we going to push forward? We are going to talk about WS Trust, WS Security, and we are going to make very, very clear the difference between the passive case and the active case. How many of you know what is the passive case? Five? Can I ask you to actually be slightly more enthusiastic? If you just go, this, I really have a hard time seeing you. And how about, how many of you know about the active case? Okay, thank you. Great. And by, like, in 10 minutes, all of you will know with way more detail that you actually wanted. And then, after we'll have that clear, we'll move ahead and we'll talk about WCF, the model of WCF, and how Windows Identity Foundation can be weaved into its pipeline. And we'll see that there are many similarities with what we have seen yesterday. I was not joking when I said that Windows Identity Foundation unifies the model for passive programming and active programming, at least from the end developer perspective. Of course, there are various differences that are intrinsic to the way in which WCF process messages as opposed to ASP.NET. And also, if some of you are WCF daredevil today, well, there are a few little changes that you'll have to accommodate, changes for the better, of course, that we have in Windows Identity Foundation. How many of you are WCF users? A lot. Perfect. Great. So for you guys, you'll appreciate that specific part. And then I will actually spend quite some time on the trust channel and the ACTAS features. And I don't want to spoil you the surprise, and I will not tell anything more about that until the right moment. So, how many of you know what is WS Security? Good amount. Okay. So, every year you read on the various brochures sentences that open the case study with, in today's world, enterprises are increasingly connected and similar. And that's true, but it's a picture that the industry has been using for something like 10 years, 12 years. So it's back at the time, like at the very late 90s or early 2000, which with the various ERP, which was pretty much the first software that sat at the nexus of many business functions, that it became clear that it was no longer possible to have software in isolation that doesn't talk with any other product. And everything was starting to hurt the industry, because people were very careful in buying software, saying, hey, what if I buy this and it ends up being a silo? like it was already dreaded as a word. And so there were various efforts for making sure that the software can talk to each other, or in general, modeling remote systems. So how many of you remember what was CORBA? Look at that. I can see some white hair there as well, right? Unfortunately, I have my share. So CORBA was a Visa titanic attempt to actually regulate everything in a distributed system. Like, it was literally like the phone book of Los Angeles. It was a very thick specification which tried to regulate everything. It had this central object broker. It was still very remoting-like. It was a pre-service orientation. However, the point is, that effort didn't really succeed. Let's say that today, I don't know if you see any system with CORBA in production, but it's a long time I don't see one. So, and the point is, at least at the idea at the time was that it was simply like way too complex. They tried to do too many things. At the same time, we saw this rise of this approach to distributed computing, which we like to call service orientation. And this idea of all these various autonomous services which expose themselves to the external world using contracts, and in which instead of having the concept of remote instances, like we just give up on the illusion that we can control stuff that lives outside of our machine, and we just think in terms of messages. So the core that made this possible was a very nimble, very simple, at least at the beginning, specification. And this specification was SOAP. How many of you guys are familiar with SOAP? Hey, look at this clean, clean class. I couldn't resist, sorry. So SOAP is this XML-based model. And today, XML-based, duh. But at the time, it was a kind of like quite a revolution. Like at the time, you needed to know if you were talking with a platform or another, because you needed to know if you had to flip the order of the bytes. And instead, moving to XML was a kind of like a big deal, because that stuff was stuff of the past. Of course, you'd pay the bloated tax, which is text-based message, but today it's absolutely the standard. Like, if we want to talk between the two platforms, like, we absolutely have SOAP capability everywhere. And the beauty of SOAP was that a message was basically following roughly this structure. This part, which we like to call the payload, was actually the part that was performing the function. Let's say that if I was calling in a service which makes A plus B, here I would have A and B, codified in some way as described by SOAP and its sister specification, the WSDL, WSDL. I don't know how you actually pronounce it here in the States. And then, and here there's the part that I really love, that's the part that allowed the SOAP to remain nimble instead of trying to boil the ocean like CORBA did. In this area, which we call the SOAP headers, basically we left a blank space for adding whatever other functionality we know we need in the protocol, but that we didn't want to specify at first. Let's say that SOAP was just the base. We just described the messaging, but none of the advanced capabilities that in a business-grade system you absolutely need. Classic example. Let's say that you want to guarantee that all on a sequence of messages is received and processed in a certain order, and every message is processed only once instead of multiple times. So here, we just added one header, which at the time we called WS a reliable messaging header, in which we added a conversation ID and a serial number, serial meaning 1, 2, 3, like a sequence number, so that whoever received this message could add a layer in front of a service in itself, rather than in the code of a service, which would potentially ignore the body and just go straight to the header and do whatever is necessary for enforcing what we wanted it to. Sounds familiar? something in front of a service instead of inside of the app. Yes, service orientation. And of course, this example is the easy example, but what we are interested in here is what we did in terms of security. Security was one of the very first missing things that the industry was pressured to solve. Because the SOAP was nice, but unless you use HTTPS, you'd be in trouble because XML is easily readable. And also, the transport had limitations. Like, for example, let's say that I'm paying the salaries of 5,000 employees twice a month. And let's say that when I send the message that says, yes, please pay, I want to make sure that I'm as solid as possible. Like, for example, I want non-repudiation, so that if I actually do the payment, and if later the payee complains that I did it without really having authorization, I can exhibit something saying, hey, man, you put an asymmetric signature in here, so don't come blaming me. So WS Security was the very first of the WS Star specifications, and I'm a kind of a nut for that. Like, my driving license, my license plate is actually WS Star. So that's why I'm boring you for 10 minutes on the subject. But I think it's important to see that in perspective. WS Security did mainly two things. One thing was describing how to immerse in the XML SOAP world existing cryptographic material. So if you had an X509, if you had username and password, if you had any other, how to say, key cryptographic material, credential type, and you wanted to use it in this context, WS Security described what we today call security tokens, which is something we used already yesterday, and how to actually position that in the context of a SOAP message. And then it described two other things, let's say, the possibility of using those tokens for signing or for encrypting a message or part of it. So basically, it just described these elements that you can use for actually assigning signatures. And that was all very fine and dandy, and also very early 2000, like PKI all over the place. PKI is nice, but it's also not very agile. Let's say that you cannot give a certificate for everything that moves, and in certain systems, you may end up having to do it. And at the same time, like, it was clear that they needed a model that was as flexible, for example, as Kerberos, in which you can actually ask contextually for a token, which is manufactured on the fly, as opposed to be a projection of another entity, like a certificate. And so enter WS Trust. WS Trust is one specification which builds on top of WS Security, and basically describes an STS. An STS that we have been happily using it for the entire day yesterday, but we used it in passive profile. Let's say that instead of actually making proper web service calls, we had it simulated, but more or less is the same concept. Okay. So now, more or less, you have an idea of what those guys mean and the structure of a SOAP message. Now, let's take a look at the difference between passive case and active case, and that will also give me a chance of going more into the details of WS Trust and the terminology that you need to use when you use WF. So let's clean this guy up, and let's make a schema of what happened yesterday. Here, yesterday, we had our user with the browser. Sorry, but being a shareholder, I like to put a little E here when it's a browser. Here, we have a relying party. And here, we have a passive STS. What does it mean, passive? It means, simply, in this case, that all the actors here, actually, the client here, like the user or its own agent, is unable to perform advanced cryptography and is unable to actually make like explicit messaging. Like it's just a browser. So it just follows whatever the address tells it to do. And it just renders whatever it receives. Like it's not a very, how to say, active client. Like it just does whatever it's told to. And so the flow is exactly as we know. So let me add a few details. Like here we have a relying party, and let's say that this is the key that we use for the relying party, like the certificate. I'm not going to write a public and a private key because otherwise it gets crowded. Let's just think that we use the correct one in the correct context. So when I use it in here, usually I'm using the private one. If instead here I'm using the key of a relying party, then of course I'm using the public one. And so the STS has the same. Here we have one key. So we know the flow. Let me change color so that it's slightly clearer. We land on a web page. Here we have some magic that forward us here. And here we are using some standard like WS Federation, which help us to ask for a token. And what we get back is a token. So let me draw a token without the lines in the middle. Here we have a token. Here we have the claims. And this token can be encrypted for the relying party and can be signed, actually can, must be signed by the STS. Now, the only way of using this guy is actually opening a pipe, possibly opaque, because like HTTPS, because we don't want anybody to steal this guy. Or if it's not encrypted, maybe we don't want people to look inside the stuff. And the only thing we can do once we receive this token is actually to send it, like attach it to whatever we are sending to our relying party. And this way, and then when the relying party receives it, it will verify this token according to a specific criteria, which we call a confirmation method. This confirmation method in the passive case is what we say a bearer token, which is pretty much like cash. I give you a banknote, and the fact that I'm the bearer of that is enough for you. Like there is no other complication implied. And that's how in the passive case things work. Now, let's actually go to the active case. And it's probably faster to just erase everything. So let's go back to our color. Are you with me so far? Passive case is easy. But also the active case is easy. So here we have again our guy, but this time we have a thick client. Who's visual here? And now we are in the world of web services. This one is again a relying party. Same key as before. And now this one is an STS. Same key as before. Now here, we don't need to do the little dance. I go to the relying party, I acquire my policy, and I go. Because for the sheer fact that I have a client, a proxy for this relying party, that means that I did read the metadata of this relying party, which describes both the format of the message that I have to send, A plus B, for example. But also, via WS security policy, what it takes for calling this relying party. So potentially, already on my client, I know what it takes. And in this case, I need to acquire a token from this STS before making the call. So I do that by sending a special message, which is ratified by WS Trust, which is called Request for Security Token. So there is a special format which allow me to describe for whom I want to get this. The list of claims that I want. What we have seen yesterday was in the passive case, when you get a token for the relying party, the list of claims is induced by your pre-existing relationship between the identity provider and the relying party. I know that customer X needs name, email, birth date. Here, in the context of my request, I can actually ask for a list of claims, which is great. Like, for minimal disclosure, that is awesome. So the STS process all these, and if happy with the result, send another message back. And with not a lot of fantasy, this is called a request for security token response. Now let's look at the token that we get. And let's change color for the sake of clarity. Since it's active, let's do a bright red. Here we have again the token. Note, this could happily be SAML. Again, this is encrypted for the underlying party, optionally, and it's signed with the identity provider. Now, the thing that we can have, like it's not mandatory, but that's what defines the active case, is this little extra element, which is one session key. Like, inside the token, apart from like just information, like claims, descriptions of my subject, I also have one key. One key which can be used when I'm actually performing a call to secure the message. So if here there's the body of a message, I can do something, I don't know if sign encrypt or whatever else, which use this key. Now, how can I do that? When I receive this token back from the STS, this key is buried inside this token. This token is encrypted for the underlying party. So how can I actually access that? Well, there is a trick. In the request for security token response, together with the token itself, we send another token, which we call a proof token, which contains nothing but the session key, and it is encrypted for the requester, or is encrypted in the context of this call. In other words, we give the token, but we also give the mean to the user or its agent, to prove that he actually has the key. So this token disappears because somehow we use it, and then we take this entire thing and we send it to the underlying party. Now, put yourself in the shoes of the underlying party. Like, you are in the thick fog, and from the fog somebody comes out, and you just see this hand with this message. You know nothing else, you just get this message. So, you see this message, the body is secured using a key that you don't know, so I'm doing nothing. So, I'm getting on the token. I see that this token is signed from the identity provider, so I'm fine, great. I see it's encrypted for me, fantastic. So, I use my private key for opening it up. I access the claims, and that's great, because those are the answers to the questions I have about the user, but I also get to this key, which now I can use for decrypting, checking signature, doing whatever I want. Now, this confirmation method, which in this case we called holder of key, well, before it was bearer, now it's holder of key, has a big, big, big advantage in respect to the former one. Whereas before I just attached the token, now I can actually use the token. Like, what I'm verifying is the ability of the user of using the token rather than the possession, rather than the fact that the user somehow came into having in his hands the token. So, of course, this is a big insurance against man in the middle, for example, because at that point, imagine that somebody just sniffs this. That's add it in the picture. And pirate, or whatever, wrongdoer. So you catch this. In the passive case, you could snatch the token, and we have a mechanism in place for mitigating the issue. we've seen yesterday that we check for duplicates. So if it's reusing the token, or if we have windows of validity, so there is a limited time for which this trick works. But anyway, those are mitigation systems. In this case, if I'm snatching the token and I'm using it for, let's say, sending my own fraudulent message, well, it won't work because the key here is buried inside the token. I didn't receive the proof token. The proof token was received by this guy and never traveled on the same line, traveled on a different line. And so, as a relying party, I receive this message, I verify that all this stuff is good, but then the key was not used. So at that point, I say, oh, I'm sorry, but you are clearly a thief, and then I want to go further. Needless to say, for using this stuff, you really don't need to understand all these. Like, this is mainly for introducing to you the terminology in a context that makes sense. Like, I could have just told you, well, that's called RST, or the proof token is something that you get there, or the active case simply means that you are able to do crypto. But I think that, like, 10 minutes are a good investment just for understanding for once what's going on under the hood. You can see why I don't do it in animation, because doing animation instead of little pictures is hard. Yes, sir? So the question is, can I touch on what happens in terms of federation? Well, that's the beauty of what we did yesterday. The pattern that we studied yesterday is absolutely the same. Let's say that the only difference here is how things travel on the wire. But in terms of pattern, is precisely the same. Like, you'd just add a step. Instead of having one STS in here, you'd have another STS between those two guys. That STS would be a resource STS. And you'd use the first token for securing the RST to the second STS. Then you'd receive an RSTR with the token that you want to use with the relying party, and business as usual. So nothing changes in respect to yesterday. Yes?
Is the relying party STS, how is that configured? In other words, how does the client know
So the question is, how does the client know how to talk with a rank party STS? It's only in the bindings. Let's say that if you look at the binding, if you analyze the bindings statically, they will tell you what to use what. Let's say that the rank party will say, I need this STS. The STS will say that it needs the other STS. And when you build the channel, basically, you take that into account. And the question is, that would work with a chained STS? Yes, of course, the complexity of a binding explodes, but yes, can be done. Anybody else? Nope. Perfect. Let's move forward. So, by raising your hands, how many of you know what is a WCF behavior? Some. WCF binding. Channel. Okay, difference between message-based security and transport-based security. Well, I'll break the news to you. Now you all know, because what we used in the passive case is clearly transport security, something that just make a opaque pipe and you use that. The message security is instead what we have seen in the active case. Note, in the active case, I can also just use the transport security. It's simply like not the defining case, but I can definitely do it. It's very common. Not every client is a client or web service stack is able to do message-based security. For example, in Silverlight, it's hard. And then there is this nice mixed mode, which is something that you can use for using transport security for ensuring confidentiality. But then you can use message security for like doing little things, like signing just a header, so that at least you have a mix of the two words. How many of you know how to use the service host class? Some? And OK. So that was just for getting a feeling of who to talk with. Okay, in practice, Windows Identity Foundation provides a service behavior. In WCF world, a behavior is something that changes the way in which the endpoint behaves, no pun intended. And what we do with Windows Identity Foundation is exactly that. Like, typically, with a service behavior, that would be what you use for like implementing a certain kind of credential or similar. So here, we just wedge ourselves in that place. And the way in which we do it is just like in ASP.NET, we used the extensibility model that it offered, like HTTP modules. In this case, we are using whatever WCF offers us. So in the next two slides, if you never worked with WCF, you may feel a bit lost. But bear with us. We'll get to parts that you'll find interesting. And basically, we have our Federated Service Credential, which is what implements this guy. And we have our own Service Authorization Manager. How many of you ever used a Service Authorization Manager? One. All right. Two. So a Service Authorization Manager is what I was using before Windows Identity Foundation for example, enforcing authorization rules on WCF. Like, that's the place that you use for extensibility, apart from when you want to create a brand new token type. And, of course, for doing the entire Windows Identity Foundation thing, we wedge ourselves in there. The object model, from the developer perspective, is the same as ASP.NET. So it's still thread, current principle, high claims principle, all that stuff is exactly the same. And in terms of configuration, you do have the same element. You simply use different sub-elements, like WS Federation now makes less sense. Pipeline is more or less the same. And this is a very important point. When you expose a web service, the metadata that describes the service itself doesn't really give away the technology that you are using for implementing the service. So from the client, when you create a client for calling a certain service, you really don't know if it's .NET, if it's Java, if it's pure WCF, or if it's WCF plus Windows Identity Foundation. So if you have XP clients on which you cannot install Windows Identity Foundation because it's not supported, well, the good news is you don't need to. If you just wanted to call a service, WCF 3.5 SP1 will be more than enough to do the job. So let me repeat for the sake of posterity. If you expose a service and a security with Windows Identity Foundation, you don't necessarily need to install Windows Identity Foundation on the client. And the pipeline is more or less what we've seen yesterday. You have the security token handler, which, by the way, is precisely the same that we had on the other case, because it's the token that tells you if it's being a bearer token or if it's a holder of key confirmation method. So it's the same class. The claims authentication manager and the claims authorization manager, since they work on claims, they are exactly the same. And in fact, in the labs that you have seen, the code for making the age threshold claims authorization manager is pretty much the same. The main difference is in the way in which we associate the policy to the resource, which is something completely arbitrary. And we could have just written a little code that works for both the case of the action and endpoint or the case of a page. We simply didn't do it for simplicity. And of course, we have again our good friend, the session security token handler, which here can assume different shapes. So how do you actually enable Windows Identity Foundation in practice in this context of this stuff? Well, if you have a self-hosted service, so you actually have a service host available, like the class, then you just make this call on service host. So the effect of a federated service credential dot configure service host is to just assign our behavior in the pipeline. Like it's just a helper class. And apart from the cases in which you host a service in your own process, that is also useful when you write your own factory. How many of you know how to use factories with WCF? Nobody. So a factory is simply a collection of things that you want to do for initializing a service, especially when this service is message activated. That's to say that you just have a HTTP listener, you receive an HTTP message, and this guy dispatches the message to the right class. If there are things that you want to do before that class comes alive, you create a factory, which just gives a sequence of things you want to do. And also, in that case, you have a visibility of a service host class, so you can use this approach. Otherwise, you have this interesting mouthful, which is configure service host behavior extension element, which is basically an extension which you can use for assigning behavior from config. This is by far my favorite, because it's like you put in a config, you flip it on, done, as opposed to something that you have to do in code. By now, you can see that I'm really wary of stuff that you do in code. I like to do stuff outside. So, for the various Captain WCF among you, here there are the things that you were doing before that you better do in a different way now. This is not the first time that the claims make their appearance in our platform. We did make our one attempt in WCF. Actually, one attempt. We did use claims, and we have a number of customers actually using the former model of claims. And in fact, you had these service security context current claims, which contained a former version of claims. Like, how many of you ever seen the term claim set? One. Okay. So the claim set was the way, because it's not deprecated yet, the way in which WCF was describing claims. However, if I'm allowed an opinion, that was like a kind of a bit of a primitive way of doing that, because those claims were, to some extent, very similar to roles. Like the approach was a role, and it was like they had tied to a resource and similar, but above all, they required you to use yet another independent API. Let's say that there was no integration with anything else. Like you would choose between using iPrinciple and Friends or using the claim set, as opposed to what we do today in Windows Identity Foundation, in which we unified the two things. So now, when you use Windows Identity Foundation in the pipeline of WCF, you should not use the former model. Let's say that we are doing things, we are taking steps for taking control of how claims are done. And so if you, for example, go in places where we use the claims in WCF in the former model, you may or may not find it in there. So in general, good idea not to go there. Operation context was the place that was keeping the various info about the current core. Now, we know that in the current principle, we have iClaims identity. So that's the best place to go look rather than this guy. Now, this is not a bug. This is very intentional. I just wanted to emphasize the difference between the approach we have in Windows Identity Foundation for handling tokens and what you had to do for example, creating a custom token handler in WCF. In WCF, you had like these very numerous family of class types that you had to do. Like you needed a serializer, a provider, an authenticator, a manager, all those kind of things. In this other approach, the Windows Identity Foundation approach, you have one single class, a security token handler, which takes care of everything, like subsidize all the stuff that we were doing before. Way simpler and way more nimble. Because sometimes you may have seen in some of the samples, that it's just a matter of deriving and overriding a couple of things. So it's very easy to make small customizations. Here, you had to do the entire thing. Like maybe you would have one class that is almost empty, or just call base everywhere, but you still needed to define the class. And in fact, we still have some of that legacy here and there. Like, we tried to simplify the model, but you can go only so far, as I'll show in a moment. Get authorization policy was using a different model. Don't use it today. Service authorization manager was the place, as I said, where you would put your logic for authenticating, for authorizing. Don't do it. Use a claims authorization manager. Much, much easier, independent from the specifics of the protocol or of the credential that you're using. Very simple. And above all, we already have our own service authorization manager, which is how we implemented WIF in WCF. So you don't want to wedge another on its place. Something interesting about the Windows Identity Foundation is that we introduced a few new bindings. Those bindings are designed for work with ADFS out of the box. That's to say that since we already know how ADFS2 expose certain STS endpoints, we created the counterparts in terms of binding, and so it's really, really easy to use those endpoints with practically no configuration at all. Actually, literally no configuration at all, because those bindings do not support configuration. So if you want to use them, you've got to do it in code. That's the way it is. So the flow here is extremely similar of what we have seen for the passive case. So how do you use, you develop using Windows Identity Foundation and WCF? Well, you write your service, which performs whatever business function you want. You don't care about security. Then all of a sudden you remember, oh, I have to care about security. So you decide which STS you want to trust to actually perform authentication on your behalf. And you run FedUtil or add STS reference from Visual Studio. That's precisely the same as before. The difference is that you will actually pick one STS which, instead of being exposed via WS Federation, you will actually pick a web service. And that's pretty much the only difference. Then in the wizard, you will have a couple of extra steps because there are more things that you have to decide. But in the end, the result is precisely the same. So at that point, you are done with the service. Also note, the wizard adds stuff like Microsoft Identity Model in your config, but it also adds the binding to your service. So that once you change your hat and from a service producer, you are a service consumer, like you create a client, here you can use the usual flow. Like you have no idea that this stuff is exposed via Windows Identity Foundation. So you get your client, you make add the service reference, you point to the metadata of the service, you get your proxy, and then you hit the F5. Very, very easy.
So the service
I apologize. Yes, and I forgot that you guys do not partake in the joys of using WCF programming. SVCUtil is a utility which is part of a .NET framework, which is somewhat similar in concept to FedUtil, but instead of being used in the context of federation, it's something that you use for creating proxies or channels for web services. It is part of a .NET framework. It is also integrated in Visual Studio. That's to say that you can go on Visual Studio in a project, right-click, add service reference, you will get a dialog that use discovery for finding the various endpoints locally, or give you the chance to type the address of one service. Once you hit that service, the system just goes there, reads the WSDL and whatever policy is attached to it, and to the best of its capabilities, it will create one proxy and will just give you this auto-generated class that you can then use for calling the service. So that's all that SVC util does. Any other questions? All right. So all the stuff so far was very, very basic. Now let's look at something slightly more exotic, something that is made possible by all the things that we have done so far and that was not possible before. So one of my favorite things. How many of you know what is a trusted subsystem? Hey, look at that. A lot of people. So rather than explaining it, I'll show you in practice. So let's say that there you have a doctor associated to a certain hospital. Doctor. So okay, now more recognizable as a doctor. And here we have one application for, let's say, one facility, like an X-ray facility or a tomography facility, which is federated with various hospitals and allow doctors to get files about their patients. So the flow is very straightforward. I get a token from the hospital, actually. Let me make explicitly the boundary of the organization. I sign in, and now I have one session. So I am on my website. I play with that. All very nice. Now, for getting the record of my patient, I now have to call a backend, which is now here. And here there is a web service that, like, let's say, gives me the record. The call between the front-end and the back-end, in the, I cannot say the vast majority of cases because I really don't have hard data, but like anecdotal evidence points to the fact that the vast majority of cases, the call between the front-end and the back-end is secured using front-end credentials. Let's say that it's the identity of the front-end application itself which is used for securing the call to the backend. So here, I represent that with a token of the same color of a backend. You can imagine this to be, for example, the certificate that I use for SSL on this website. And at that point, in this call, there will be the patients of this guy, and I'll just send back the records. So let me record of the patients. Now, what's dangerous of this picture? The danger is the following. If here I draw the boundaries of this system, like you can imagine that the moment in which I'm authenticated with this application, between this application and the rest, anything goes. That's to say that this front-end serves that doctor, which has certain patients, but serves everybody else. As a result, the front-end must have the power to read whatever record is in here. So, in other words, like everything between the from this boundary on is literally a trusted subsystem. That's to say that I cease to make checks. Like I'm more than happy with knowing it's this app. What's the problem with this? If this guy is a doctor at night and a hacker during his free time, then he may actually decide to start pounding on this front-end, because it's a front-end, it's easy to do so, and somehow it may end up subverting it so that he can make this front-end do a call that gives him back the record of that very pretty patient that he wants to stalk. So, clearly, the situation is not very secure, not very solid. Like, it would be nice to have this call which somehow reflects the actual caller, not like the godlike power of this guy. The traditional solution to this is Kerberos constrained delegation, which is even difficult to pronounce. And the pronunciation wouldn't be a problem, but the problem is administration. That's to say that while possible and extremely powerful, it's also something which is not cheap to set up and to maintain. As a result, when you ask to to administrators to set it up, usually they say no. Like, it's hard. It's hard, and also you have to be very careful in the way in which you manage it. Luckily, since we are playing with all these web services and similar, we have an easy solution. Let's say that we introduce another STS, which could be the same STS as this guy, but for the sake of a scenario, let me put this within the boundaries of the X-ray facility organization. And let's say that all of the backend services will actually trust these internal STS, as opposed to trust directly the credentials of the frontend. So if anybody wants to call this backend, they have to obtain a token from the STS. And since these STS can be made to actually support a new feature of WS Trust, which is called Act As, we can actually ask for a token here using an RST and securing it with our credential, but we can also attach the token which we obtained from the user, so that these STS can process the request, authenticate the request by seeing who is the caller, which in this case is the frontend. Like, we can still use the certificate, for example, for securing the request for security token in here. But then, if we attach this token and we declare that is the Act As token, here we may have logic which looks at the content of this guy and renders a new token which reflects that. So, for example, in this case, we may actually have the actual list of patients of this guy. So at that point, what would happen is we take that token, which we know from yesterday is what we call the bootstrap token, and we send it together with this guy. Let me do it again. We actually send both. The blue token, the certificate, is used for securing the call. This guy is just attached, saying Act As. Here I have logic which reads this thing, creates a different token on the base of that. So, see, same color. Then sends it back to the frontend, and now the frontend can happily take it, use it for making this call, and at this point this guy can hack until he's blue in the face. There is no way of subverting these to do anything but getting a different to get a different record, because at that point he'd have to act these, which is simply not available outside. So, yes, sir. The question is, how is Act As or on behalf of related or different? They are different. Act As is something which will get you a token, this green token, which has claims both for the caller, the acting as, and the actual requester, so in this case the front end. In the on behalf of case, the requester disappears. Like, what you get is fully a list of things which represent the caller. So it's a matter of grades. Like, the on behalf of is a special case of Act As in which there is nothing about the front end. It's all about the original caller. Yes, sir?
Is it correct then that on behalf of is somewhat deprecated in the web system? You guys don't use it that much?
The question is it correct to say that on behalf of is deprecated? Actually, no. Let's say that they are both in the standard, like they have the same dignity. And it's simply like a matter of how far you want to move it, depending on your context, but they are both still valid.
So it's configuration.
We'll see in a moment the object model. It's like very clear. Yes, sir. So the question is the bootstrap token the original token? Yes. The bootstrap token is what bootstrapped the session. So it is a better token which we got from this STS. This guy instead is actually a holder of key, but, well, it can also be a bearer. Don't let me meddle with waters here. But anyway, the difference is that this is a passive token and receives a token which is used in the context of one active transaction. So this STS in this case may be WS Federation and this guy WS Trust. But anyway, yes, absolutely. This guy is the original one. This has interesting implications because if, for example, the token that I get here is encrypted for this front end, but the STS that I use for some reason doesn't have the same cryptographic material, then this scenario may not be possible. That's to say that unless I am able here to decrypt this token, then of course I cannot run any rules on top of those claims. So this scenario is possible only in the case in which or the token is not encrypted, or the front end and the STS are the same cryptographic entity, which like could be, I don't know, if this guy has a public presence and it's using the SSL certificate, then this guy needs access to the same SSL certificate, but it's not that far-fetched, like it's the same organization. So, before I move again to the written slides, traditionally, no, well, I'll do it later. So, are you guys up to speed with this? Did you follow? Isn't that awesome? Like, this is really, 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 really powerful. Like, this opens up to a lot of possibilities. Also, think of a double hop. Like, here, I'm making one call. If typically you are using impersonation and similar, which is difficult to control, but anyway, typically you do one hop and then you are dead in the water. Because, of course, unless you have a Kerberos constrained delegation, you cannot make a chain of delegated calls. With this system, you can go as deep as you want. Like, if this guy needs to call somebody else and you still want the token to be, like, you go back, you do the same, you attach these as the act as token, and so on and so forth. That's very powerful. So how do you use this stuff? It's pretty straightforward. Here, let me actually highlight some of those. So the first line is what you already know. Here, I'm just retrieving the current principle, right? Then here, I am digging the current principle for finding the bootstrap token. So you remember that from time to time, I go in the config and I write save bootstrap token equal true, right? So that's what allows me to take the entire token and save it in the session. As a result, when I do so, in my claims identity, I will actually find one element which contains the entire token. Because in this case, I don't just need the claims. I need the entire token because we want the act as to be able to actually verify that. So once we have it. Here we have this little magic. Create channel acting as, which basically allow us to create like a proxy to our service where we inject the bootstrap token. As a result, we get our channel and then we can call. And when we make this call, the system basically will actually use the correct token, like the yellow token that we got before. And here we have also create channel on behalf of. I should check the object model, but I think that's the way in which we divide that. Now, this is really, really nice. This is very handy, but that's suboptimal to some extent. Well, not really suboptimal, but let's say that we can do better in certain scenarios. And I'll now tell you why. We are back here. All the stuff that you have seen takes place in the front end, like the code that we have seen is basically in here. Now, imagine what happens. Here, you made that call, and now you have this my channel. And you can just use mychannel.hello and keep calling. But this guy is a web application. So I call it, I get my render page back, I stay here in memory for some time, and then I go down. So next time somebody calls me, which could be like a couple of minutes later, I click something else, which have to make the call, the proxy here disappeared because the instance went down. So now I have to go again through all that process in which I retrieve a bootstrap token, I come here, I get a new token, and I call, which of course can be expensive. Let's say that now I have two calls at the price of one, and one of those can actually be pretty crypto intensive. Also, STSs tend to be the center of the universe, so the better I deal with them, the less I pound them uselessly, the better. And what's the answer? We need a different object model, of course. And luckily, we have it. Enter one of my favorite features of Windows at Denny Foundation, the Trust Channel Factory. Ta-da! The Trust Channel Factory is something which allows you to explicitly ask for a token to one STS. Traditionally, when you use WCF and you contact one STS, you always do that implicitly. You have one binding which says, I need a token from that STS. And that binding will make the magic happen between your client and the STS, and then it will get the token and will use it. But you never see the token. Also, some other time, let's not go too far. No, yes, let's go too far. Also, when you have already a token for some reason, like sometimes you manufacture your own self-signed token. Some other time you somehow manage to save it and you have it in your stash, and you want to use that token for calling a service. There was no straightforward way of doing that in WCF. Like WCF had the bindings. Bindings were the way in which you obtain a token. Instead, now we have create channel with issued token, which does exactly that. Like I can create a channel to one service, injecting a token. So those are actually two different things. One thing is the WS Trust Channel, which is something that I can use for obtaining a token directly from STS. So now in memory, I actually have one class, one instance containing the token. And then I also have, and this guy is actually a generic XML security token. So a grab bag of everything. And then I have this create channel with issued token, which I can use for injecting the token I just obtained. The question is, this feature is available only when the client has Windows Identity Foundation. That is correct. Like, this is a new class introduced by Windows Identity Foundation. Yes, sir?
So there's another API to add ActDabs to this code
snippet here? There is, and we'll see that in a moment. I forgot the question. So there is another API for adding ActDabs to this situation. And the answer is absolutely yes. We'll see it in a moment. So let's just look at the code here. Can you guys read it also from the back? Okay. So, what do we do in here? First, we just initialize the trust channel to one STS, which basically means the address and the binding of STS. Of course, it's a web service like anything else, needs a binding for being secured. So, we create the channel, and then here is the interesting part. Those two lines, we actually create explicitly an RST. And in this case, the only thing that we add is the applies to. But if you'd wanted ActDes, we'd have room for assigning the ActDes token. And then here, we just get an RST, and we obtain it just making channel.issue. Could not be simpler than this. Once we obtained the token, we create a service channel using the create channel with issued token. We inject the token, and we are done. That's really, really handy.
So the RSTR, the response, and token, there are two different entities. I thought the token would be part of RSTR.
The question is the token and the RST different entities? And the question is, absolutely different. Like, the fact that one thing contains another doesn't in any way imply that the two things are the same. So the token is there, but it's also here. So it's just for like ease of use. In fact, you may want to keep the RST because it may contain other info that you want to, proof token and stuff like that. But having the token directly like this is very handy because, as you can see, the line just after, I can use it. Okay. So from the STS side, let's say you are an STS, and you receive a RST which contains actors. Well, that's very easy to act upon it, because instead of making a request dot get subject claims, you just have a request dot actes. So exactly the same, just add an actes in the middle. So very straightforward. And actually, I'll show you a bit of code, and then you'll have your well-deserved break. Let's see what we have. Okay. So here I have one classic example, which you can download from the internet, which basically represents a shipping utility. So let's say that you have one ISV which offers this application to enterprise customers. Enterprise customers can use this application for sending packages. And this application is hosted on the premises of the ISV or on the cloud or whatever. Anyway, not on the premises of an enterprise. But through claims, everything goes happily in single sign-on and similar. So here I'm recognized as John. Okay. I tried to zoom and it took some time. So let me create a new shipment. Here you can see some info about my about myself, and let's see who guess from where I got this information. Token, claims, perfect. So let me pick one customer. Okay, submit. Yeah, I'm happy with it. Fine, almighty fine. So for doing all this, I was calling a backend, of course. And this backend also have some business rules. So for example, if I try to do an operation that I know I'm not allowed to, like rerouting a shipment, what happens is that here I get an error which says, sorry, you can't do that. So how did we actually enforce all this? Here we have our little project. It is actually not that little, but still manageable. How many of you saw this example before? Fabricam Shipping? Not bad. Well, you can easily download that and study it if you want. Well, apparently today our Zoom is not working very well. Well, that's okay. So here we have our front end. I won't go into the details of a web config, but of course, here we have the page where we have seen all the claims. And that's where we make the magic happen. And it's just as easy as making the usual code here. Here we are using claims as they are. We are not really doing any act-as stuff yet. All business as usual. Now let's look at the interesting stuff. Let's say, how did we actually obtain the act-as token and similar? Now, before I show you the code, let me remind you that now we are very far from yesterday's claims-based identity is easy. Click, 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 I outsource my authentication. Done. Now we are fully under the hat of the security experts that are designing a complex system. So don't be scared if you see a lot of code. And it's still a fraction of what we were supposed to write in the past. So here we have our good friend global ASAX. Let me zoom a bit. Somehow today the zoom is very slow. So here we just retrieve our usual principle. It's an Eclipse principle, surprise, surprise. Note, here we are in session start. So this is the very first thing that we do as soon as we have the authenticated token available. We get our SAML security token as the bootstrap token, and it's directly in here as a property. Then we have our utility function, which gets the delegated token, and then, not very load balancer friendly, we just shove it in the session. Of course, you guys can do better. Don't do this at home. Then let's take a look at the get delegated token. Get delegated token actually has a lot of stuff. I'm waiting for the zoom to kick in, and here it is. Here we define our binding, the binding that we use for calling the Actasis service. And we are using the as credential the message mode, like message mode security, and we are actually using the certificate of the application, exactly as I described before. And so here, basically what we are doing is all WCF stuff, like we are creating the binding and retrieving the credential we want to use in the binding. So nothing strange so far. Then we create our trust channel factory, which we will use for obtaining the token. We adjust a couple of things in our context. We assign the credentials. And we should have somewhere the Actas as well. And here we are. Control 1. Okay, perfect. So here we create the requests of our security token. As Actas, we assign the caller token. So here we are explicitly doing what we were doing with the create channel acting as. We assign the endpoints to what we are interested into. We create our channel, and then we just call issue, and we get delegated token. That's all there is to do. And then I could show it, but I'm not sure if that's especially especially interesting. The client that we use for making the call is simply something that uses create channel with issued token. Like we just get the delegated token every time, and we use it for making the call. So very, very straightforward. And just for the record, here I'm showing you the method that I called, which failed. Let me pick the right one, shipping modifier, reroute shipment. Here we go. Waiting for the zoom to kick in, and here we are. So here there's the method that I called. What's missing from this method? Exactly. Like there is not a single sign of security. Like here, when I write this function, I want to reroute the shipment. Perfect. I reroute the shipment. I absolutely don't know or care about all these milestone of things that is taking place in the protocol in front of me. Like Actas, what's that? I don't care. I am an expert in business process, in provisioning, and that's what I'm doing. Perfect. But of course, this stuff does happen. So where does that happen? It happens in the service host. So here we have our service host. If we take a quick look at the config, I will spare you the binding. Here we are at our good friend, the identity model. here, note this little cameo, is we actually making one role claim type mapping, as we discussed yesterday, about the things that I can change when I'm modifying the SAML token. Small out of context cameo. So you can see it works exactly the same in WCF or in ASP.NET. And here I have my good friend Claims Authorization Manager, which is using a custom claim and a custom class. And here I'm just assigning my usual policies. So that's what makes that authorization happen. And in terms of the token, of course, that's the binding. So that's very, very straightforward. And that said, if you guys have questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, I suggest that you take a good 15-minute break, since starting the day with crypto and WCF is not necessarily the easiest way to getting off the bed. Yes, sir?
Does that sample include showing how
you can use the proof token? The question is, does the sample show how to use a proof token? And the answer is, yes, it does, but you don't really see it. Let's say that what you see here is, I want to use message security. That takes care of everything for you. Yes, sir?
Does the saving of the bootstrap token grow the size of the fedOps cookie?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
The saving of bootstrap tokens, does that increase the size of the fedOps cookie that you're landing the browser?
The question is, does then saving then the bootstrap token increase the size of the cookie? And the answer is possibly. We have two ways of saving cookies. One is by value, in which case, absolutely, yes. Like you take all the bits of that token and you just add them. Of course, there is the inflate, deflate, so it's not exactly one-to-one. It compresses it a bit, but still, it definitely makes it bigger. Or there is a different way, which is by doing by reference. Let's say that instead of actually saving everything in the cookie you just save a reference to something that you put in the session state. At that point, every time you come back, you will use that reference to rehydrating the state, and then at that point on the client, you see nothing. Like the size is still the size of a reference, regardless of what's inside the session. The question is it a configuration thing to change the session mode, or do you have to write custom classes? And the answer is kind of a mix between the two. That's to say that you cannot just do it in the configuration, but doing it in code is absolutely trivial. That's to say that in the in application start, you just go and you take the session authentication module, and you put the ease session mode to true, that will flip the behavior. That's enough. That's enough to do that. But so you don't have to subclass anything. It's just a switch. But you do have to write some code. Anybody else? So the question is, here there was a custom handler and we didn't see it in yesterday's passive scenario. And the answer is, we did see it in the security scenario. Is that in the passive scenario. It was probably lost in the ocean of things that we talked about in the last section. But if you remember a representation of the config file, there were the four configs that you can use for certain token types, like the SAML in which you have the mappings. But then there was this custom, in which you can make the add, and instead of using an existing token handler type, you can put your own. So it's precisely the same.
By default,
there is no default. That depends by what the kind of token that you are using. Let's say that by default, you have a collection of security token handlers which is in memory. If you want to alter that collection, you can add, delete, or clean. You can do all the things that a standard collection in a speed.net configuration can do. And depending on the type that you will find in the config, it will actually match that. Like you have all those handlers, when they start, they vote saying, yes, I'm available for processing this type of token. And depending on when that type of token merge, the bits will be dispatched to one class or to the other. Like, is precisely the same in this case or in the passive case.